Well, welcome back to our second hour, and joining us now, he deserves a Medal of Honor for doing this because it's 7 a.m. out in Vancouver. Our mercenary geologist, Mickey Folt. Mickey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. It's supposedly summertime, but it really hasn't hit up here. We're looking at it's about mid-50s and raining and gray, and that's pretty typical for June in Vancouver.
Now, you have an apartment or something then up there in Vancouver, don't you?
Yeah, I have a little apartment in the Cole Harbour area downtown. It's quite convenient, about a block from the beginning of this financial district.
So, I know you live in New Mexico, born in, what was it, Colorado? Or no, you were born in Missouri.
Correct, Missouri.
Yeah, yep. then lived some time in Colorado, live in New Mexico, but have an apartment in Vancouver.
Well, I never really have lived in Colorado. I spent most of my life in New Mexico, grew up in Missouri, and my business is based in Vancouver for the most part, because that's where all the money comes for the mining business, and so I maintain an apartment up here too.
Okay, so what turned you into a Broncos fan?
St. Louis Cardinals left St. Louis and moved to Phoenix, so I had the opportunity to become a fan of a good football team about 20 years ago.
Gotcha. All right, just trying to connect all the dots here in Vancouver, because you're up there a lot. Mickey and I, we're going to start off talking about the little ice age from 1300 to 1850. It's a good thing Al Gore and the weather alarmists weren't around back then. So tell me a little bit about the little ice age.
Well, it is somewhat of an inconvenient truth. The Little Ice Age, nearly a 500-year period, 1350 more or less to 1850, and it was somewhat cooler, 2 to 3 degrees centigrade, which would be something like 4 to 6 degrees Fahrenheit. And it occurred right after something called the medieval warm period, which was a 300-year period in which temperatures were 4 to 7 degrees C higher than they are today. So it created a lot of havoc in the world, this little ice age, and glaciers advanced, and there were cold summers, and there were snows and rains and floods and famines, and it coincided also the beginning of it with the Black Death, the plague in Europe, and it's estimated that 1/3 of the human population died during that period of time in the 1350s. Kind of came and went over a period of 500 years. There would be very cold periods and then a little warmer periods, but it pretty much shaped the world as we know it right now.
You know, I saw a study out of the University of Texas that was released last week that shows that the recent melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet is actually caused by geothermal heat from undersea volcanoes, instead of this man-made global warming, and excluding that one area that sits above those undersea volcanoes, the rest of it, we have the highest levels of sea ice since 1979. And yet, the weather alarmists, they kind of ignore that inconvenient truth.
Well, you know, I have to go back and say, you know, go look at your weatherman's 7-day forecast. And, you know, when you and I grew up as kids, they forecast the weather a couple of days. Now they do it 7 days. But see how accurate that is. So the point being that weather change, climate change, if we can't get the weather right over a 7-day period, how are we going to get climate change and warming of the earth or cooling of the earth? Now, as far as the little ice age goes, there's lots of good evidence. We know it occurred. Why it occurred, we're not really sure. There's been about five theories proposed. All of them make sense. Indonesian volcanoes, we had big volcanic eruptions starting in the late 1250s and going all the way up to 1815, and that's when Tambora went off, and that was followed by the year without a summer in 1816. So volcanoes putting particulate matter, ash, and sulfur dioxide and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere blocks out sun, essentially, and that's one possible reason. Orbital cycles of the Earth, there's this precession in the Earth, and it tilts a little bit more or less in cycles as it goes around the sun. That could be a reason. A really strong case can be made for a lack of sunspots. So we have this periodicity and sunspot activity on the sun, and when there are fewer sunspots, the Earth tends to cool because there's less solar radiation, and there's a minimum in sunspot activity. There's actually three minimums during the Little Ice Age, and one 1645 to 1715 actually coincides exactly with the coldest part of the Little Ice Age, and that was -5 to -6 degrees C. Well, to put that into perspective, that's 10 to 12 degrees Fahrenheit colder than it is right now, and that's a significant cooling of the Earth. So, and then a couple other reasons possibly is when you have these warm periods, which we did prior to the Little Ice Age, we have freshwater melting of glaciers in the North Atlantic, and that can wreak havoc on what's called the oceanic circulation pattern, which basically is cold water coming off Antarctica, cold, dense, salty water, and warm water on the surface. So that can change circulation patterns. And then finally, it just could be the inherent variability of the climate. So no one quite knows why it happens. We know it happens, and the current dogma about global warming, if you go back and look, in the early 70s, people were calling for the next ice age was around the corner.
I remember that the same crowd that got started on the global warming back 30, 40 years ago were telling us we were heading into another ice age for the same reason.
Well, that's correct. In 1968, probably the most famous of these environmentalist climatologist types would be Paul Ehrlich, and he wrote something called The Population Bomb, and in that particular book, he states categorically, we cannot predict overall climatic results. That's a direct quote. And in 1972, there was a global weather climate conference, and all the experts came out and said the natural end of our warm epoch is near. So they were predicting a pending ice age. So I think the point being here is climate and weather and the variability of the Earth is way too complicated for people to really accurately predict. And so we tend to go in these cycles of thought, and sometimes that becomes dogma with not a lot of science behind it. And the case can be made, certainly the Earth is warming. We know that. The cause of why it's warming, we're really not sure. Certainly, in my opinion, part of it's man-caused. You know, we're putting a lot of more CO2 in the atmosphere on a yearly basis, and mainly that's because of burning of coal. So I have to say the idea we're going to stop global warming, I think, is fraught with difficulty. In fact, I would say it borders on ludicrous. You know, we got given the fact that coal is the biggest problem, burning of coal for electricity constitutes 44% of all the carbon emissions on the planet. Well, they're on the books right now. There are 1,200 new coal-fired power plants on the books being either built or proposed. Two-thirds of those are in China and India, and they're going to go in because those people are demanding electricity. So the idea we're going to be able to stop it, well, you better be able to stop China and India from building more coal-fired power plants. Good luck on that.
Mickey, I know you're a geologist, not a meteorologist, and by the way, you can go to mercenarygeologist.com. Why is Europe so warm relative to its position? I mean, hell, the UK's almost up there in the Arctic Circle.
I would say it's got everything to do with the Gulf Stream. England, I think London is on latitude more or less 55 degrees north. Well, you go 55 degrees north on the other side of the Atlantic, and you're up in far northern Quebec, where in Labrador, in that part of the world, where it's extremely cold. So it's the Gulf Stream, which is part of this global circulation pattern of oceanic currents, and cold water comes off Antarctica, and it circulates around and goes up to the Aleutians and then circulates back down through the Indian Ocean and across the tip of southern Africa, and then comes roaring up into the Mid-Atlantic and takes a bend over the Gulf of Mexico, and it becomes essentially you have this very warm current coming up from the tropics, the Gulf Stream, which goes up to Greenland and over to Iceland and up into to skirt Scandinavia and then comes back down. So that warms a significant part of northern Europe. In fact, I worked a couple of years ago, I worked for a period of time above the Arctic Circle, or essentially right on the Arctic Circle in Finland. And we're talking the Arctic Circle, and you can imagine what the Arctic Circle is in North America. That's for the most part of the year, a cold, frozen climate. Well, there's farms on the Arctic Circle in Finland. There's highways. It's boreal forest and farms. So people farm up there. They have livestock. And that has all to do with the Gulf Stream.
Yeah, whenever I think about it, Iceland's green and Greenland's iced. Was that reversed at one point? And that's how they got their name?
Well, certainly during the medieval warm period, when the first northern Europeans, the Norse, settled in Greenland, it was much greener than it is now. So we talked about this medieval warm period, and that's when Greenland was settled by essentially the Vikings. And they had a booming civilization there. They raised sheep. They grew grains. And then they got hit by this little ice age By about 1400, they were devastated. All life failed there, and they basically starved to death because they were trying to raise sheep and they didn't know how to fish in the winter. And the Eskimos up there survived because they had ivory harpoons and they could go out and fish and kill seals, et cetera, in the winter, and the Vikings couldn't do that. So, yes, Greenland at one point was much greener than it is now. Has to do with that medieval warm period, and then the ice advanced during the little ice age.
Mickey, I've got a nephew that lives in Alaska. He's an Alaska trooper. And his mom lives here in Atlanta, and we've been spending a lot of time together. And they're undergoing their own earthquake swarm at the moment. Am I catching you cold on that one, or are you familiar with it?
Well, I didn't know there was an earthquake swarm ongoing. You know, we really track big earthquakes, and we tweet all those greater than six, but I was unaware there's an earthquake swarm in Alaska, but that's of concern because the world's second largest recorded earthquake, and you and I are both old enough to remember this, was in I think Good Friday of 1964, and it was 9.2, if memory serves, and killed a bunch of people. Capsized boats from the tsunami as far away as New Orleans, wiped out Crescent City, California. So this would be of concern because that's on the plate boundary and historically has had giant earthquakes, largely centered around the Aleutian Islands and on up into to the Anchorage area.
So should we tell him, watch out, the big one might be coming?
We've talked about these earthquake swarms before and what they mean, and they can be precursors to bigger earthquakes, but that's not well determined. But it certainly would be a warning that perhaps something is getting ready to pop.
And that Alaska, that area, that is along the Ring of Fire, correct?
Absolutely. The Aleutian Islands are a string of volcanoes that go from essentially the Cook Inlet south of Anchorage and go all the way out to essentially Russia, a long archipelago. And yes, it is one of the most active parts of the Ring of Fire. The Aleutian Islands.
You know, I always think of a story my father-in-law told me. He was in the Navy, and they were going, for some reason, they were going to the Aleutian Islands, and now Navy men guys are. Somebody asked their commander if there were pretty women up there on the Aleutian Islands, and the guy responded, yeah, there's a pretty woman behind every tree. Of course, there aren't any trees on the Aleutian Islands, and the sailors didn't realize that until they got up there. But that, anytime I hear the term Aleutian Islands, I think about that comment.
Oh, that's interesting. But, yeah, as soon as we get off the radio here, as soon as I get off the radio, I'm going to go check out this earthquake swarm in Alaska. I was totally unaware that was going on. One thing I'd like to say is the little ice age is probably gave us beer. So prior to the little ice age, there were grapes grown in England and in various places of Northern Europe. And when the little ice age set in, all the grapes failed there. They froze, and so the love of humans have for alcohol, that's when we started making lots of beer and out of cereal grains. And of course, the U.S. was mainly settled by Northern Europeans, especially in the early migrations. And to this day, we drink 23 times the amount of beer than wine in the United States. So let's tip a glass of beer over that.
You know, back when I was in high school and the guy was warning about us slipping into another ice age, I was under the impression, perhaps mistakenly, that we were actually coming out of a little mini ice age.
Well, we are. I mean, the little ice age, we're still coming out of that. We're still coming. We historically have been warming since the last global ice age, when the ice retreated somewhere between 10 and 12,000 years ago. So the case could be made that we are certainly in one of these intraglacial periods. Those things often last, there's a periodicity around 15 to 40,000 years, so the case certainly can be made in looking a longer-term horizon that that we are coming out of an ice age, and there's another one coming. We, you know, if you remember back, I think in January, we talked about the 10 geological catastrophes waiting to happen, and ice age is certainly one of those, and certainly we would expect an ice age to commence somewhere in the next perhaps 10 to 25,000 years.
What are we likely to see out of another little mini ice age?
If we get another ice age, well, we're going to see advance of ice sheets, thick ice sheets. You know, New York City was buried under something 3 to 4 kilometers of ice. When that happens, sea level drops. It would wreak havoc on current civilization as we know it, and even something as small as an event as the Little Ice Age basically changed the course of human history with famines, the Irish potato famine, diseases, especially the plague, the Black Death, and typhus, and there were food riots that led to the French Revolution. There were despots such as Napoleon who tried to conquer the world. There were witch hunts all over, blaming the cold and the snows for witches. So the last one, this little ice age, certainly wreaked havoc. One-third of the population of the world disappeared. Now, admittedly, I think there was only about 150 million people on the planet at that point. You know, the big problem we have right now is the population's grown. We're well over 7 billion people now, 7.2 billion people, and about something 35% of those people, well over a third of those people live in China and India, and which are relatively poor and undeveloped countries. And with communications now, those people see what we have and they want it. So they want electricity, they want computers and phones and all those things. Currently, we generate electricity for the most part by fossil fuels, and that contributes to CO2 in the atmosphere, and likely is at least a partial reason why the climate is why the Earth is warming.
If plants breathe in CO2 and exhale oxygen.
That's correct.
All right. Why would an abundance of CO2 be harmful for life on the planet overall? Or is it?
Well, it's debatable if it is or not. It is viewed by humans to be harmful to humans. It's likely just the natural course of things. You know, historically, if you look at the history of the Earth, the present CO2 levels in the atmosphere are very low. Certainly, they are much lower than when the dinosaurs were around. You know, the climate that we have now is fairly quite anomalous in terms of the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, lower than it has been most periods of time. But, you know, humans have this ego that we are the most important species on the planet. And as a geologist and someone who studies the history of the Earth, you know, we're a blip on the radar screen in terms of the time we've been around. Certainly we affect the climate of the Earth, but so did the dinosaurs. And, you know, it's just we're just one catastrophic event of wiping out huge parts of all the species on planets again.
Mickey, I know this has been a year of several mudslides. Mudslides to me, as a layperson, I mean, Are that we really considering these geological disasters as just a bunch of mud and rain and then it slides?
Well, yeah, that's a geological disaster. It's generally caused by weather in the atmosphere, and the atmosphere is really, it's part of planetary science, but not really part of geological science. But the movement of Earth, whatever the reason is certainly a geological event that can be triggered. Mudslides, landslides, mud flows, floods can be triggered by weather. They can be triggered by volcanoes. They can be triggered by earthquakes. A variety of reasons, but whatever the cause of those those earth movements, catastrophic earth movements, they are certainly geological events when Earth moves around by the force of gravity.
What do you think is likely to be the next big one that we're going to deal with before the end of the year? Not just mudslides, but in geological terms, or is it just too soon to say?
Well, we're still expect something on the order of, we're almost halfway through the year. We get 15 earthquakes greater than 7.0 on a yearly basis. So certainly we're going to have some more big earthquakes. Likely we will have an 8.0 sometime within the next year. We average one of those every year. So that's the likely geological catastrophe that's going to happen within the next year. And of course, we never quite know when some big volcano is going to erupt. And we get one of these big volcanoes about once every 10 to 100 years. So the last really huge eruption we had was Tambora in 1815. It was a 7 on the volcano index. They call it the VEI, the Volcano Explosive Index. So at some point, we're going to have a big volcano. Chances of that happening the next year are pretty slim, but certainly in the next 10 to 100 years, we're due for a big volcanic eruption.
I always think of Yellowstone when we talk about volcanic eruptions. And I know we had a little mini earthquake swarm out there, but that obviously has not been any precursor to something major. But what does your gut tell you? You think we'll see that thing blow in our lifetime?
No.
Okay.
My gut says no, but, I'm probably only going to be on the planet another, if I'm lucky, another 25 years. So I don't think it's going to happen that quick. But certainly, it's overdue. It blows on average every big volcanic eruption every 600,000 years. We are now 640,000 years since the latest Yellowstone supervolcanic eruption, and that certainly would wreak devastation on the Earth.
Well, I mean, we were having a little mini swarm in Yellowstone back in March, as I recall.
Yeah, but that's earthquake. It's not a volcanic eruption. So those little mini earthquake swarms, I mean, Yellowstone's a seismically active area historically. And when was it? The Madison earthquake in the late 50s, if memory serves, was a 7.4 or something like that on the Richter scale or earthquake magnitude scale. So earthquakes are not unusual, and big earthquakes in that part of the world. But big earthquakes do not mean that Yellowstone's getting ready to blow. Certainly when the magma chamber, when magma starts moving around underneath Yellowstone, we would expect increased earthquake activity, but doesn't really work the other way around. Increased earthquake activity does not indicate specifically that a volcanic eruption is imminent.
We're speaking to Mickey Pope. The website, again, is mercenarygeologist.com. Mickey's Twitter handle is at mercenarygeo. So with Yellowstone being a caldera, basically the sunken area of a previous earthquake, I mean a volcano, and that is that a good description of a caldera?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. And then we've got this earthquake activity. Isn't there always earthquake activity associated with volcanoes? Aren't they somehow really almost one and the same event, or am I wrong there?
No, I think you don't quite have it correct. Certainly when we've learned, and we learned a lot of this when Mount St. Helens blew up about 34 years ago or something, that we, with all these new measuring devices and GPS, we got all these GPS stations around these active volcanoes, and certainly when they exhibit increased earthquake activity, generally small earthquake swarms prior to eruption, but taking those earthquake swarms and predicting the timing of an eruption or the magnitude of that eruption is fraught with difficulty. Basically, we can't do it, and I don't think we will ever be able to predict exactly when a volcano is going to erupt or the magnitude of that eruption. Too many factors we don't understand. So to correlate volcanic eruptions with increased a volcanic eruption with increased earthquake activity, seismic activity, there certainly is some correlation, but it's not a predictive correlation. In other words, when you start seeing a bunch of little earthquakes around an active volcano, that does not mean that it's imminently going to erupt at all.
But like with Yellowstone, I mean not Yellowstone, but Mount St. Helens, even though long range we couldn't determine, I mean, they did kind of know within the immediate few days that it was getting ready to blow, didn't they?
Yeah, but they had no idea it was going to be anywhere near as big or devastating as it was. There was a lava dome growing inside the crater, and there were lots of little earthquakes around, and they could tell magma was moving around. But that whole thing came as a surprise. I mean, 10 years ago, that volcano, 10 years before it blew, that volcano was, or even 5 years, was thought to be an inactive, not extinct, but inactive volcano. And all of a sudden it blew up. Most of those big cascade volcanoes are inactive, but that does not mean they can't, in a period of a year or 5 years, cannot become active again and explode. So it was quite a surprise.
So, I mean, it's possible that one day Mount Rainier could suddenly decide to rear its ugly head?
Absolutely. Mount Baker, Mount Adams, Mount Rainier, Mount St. Helens again. We just really don't know. They, for the most part, are inactive volcanoes, but they can wake up at it. Well, it has to do with the Ring of Fire, and that's an active part of the subduction zone there. There's a very good reason why those big cascade volcanoes are where they are. There are big faults that go through there along that plate boundary, so there's active subduction zone there.
Is Yellowstone the furthest volcano eastward?
The current semi-active active volcano, yeah, but it's not really connected to plate tectonics. It's one of these mantle hot spots that's inboard. A mantle hot spot is a portion of the mantle that which magma wells up that, as far as we know, has no real connection to plate tectonic boundaries.
They're on the continent of North America, east of the Mississippi River. There are no volcanoes, correct?
No active volcanoes, and haven't been for a number of years, to my knowledge.
Are there any that are
inactive? Well, we're talking eastern U.S.
Yeah, eastern
Certainly
United States.
There are active volcanoes in eastern Mexico, but that's quite a ways south. But, yeah, that's old, for the most part, old crust, old mountain building, the Appalachians, et cetera. And those areas have been largely dormant for a whole lot of years, 300 to 400 million years.
Are there any known inactive volcanoes east of the Mississippi that, you know, we've just written
No.
off?
No, not in the U.S., okay? We got lots in the Caribbean, lots in Mexico, et cetera, near plate boundaries, but the eastern U.S., no.
So we have to go, what, all the way to Iceland to get one?
No, you could go into the Caribbean, San Martinique, some of those volcanic islands in the Caribbean, so that'd probably be the closest. But going north, yeah, Iceland would be the nearest one north. And Iceland's an interesting place because not only is it on a plate tectonic boundary, the Mid-Atlantic Spreading Ridge, which largely accounts for the volcanoes on Iceland, but it's also on top of one of these mantle hotspots. So that is likely... I would surmise that the real danger from volcanic eruptions on the Earth that we have right now, the most immediate danger, and we're talking, you just don't know. This could be 1 year, it could be 10,000 or 100,000 years, but the Iceland volcanoes are likely the next giant geological catastrophe waiting to happen.
Okay, we've been speaking with Mickey Folt. Mickey is the Mercenary Geologist, mercenarygeologist.com. The Twitter handle is at Mercenary Geo. Now, Mickey, here lately, we've been talking mainly geology over these last several months, but Mickey's a bit of an expert when it comes to a lot of the stuff that we dig out of the ground. What are your thoughts right now on gold and silver?
I think they're going to both tread water for the end of the year. I certainly expect to test the recent lows, since the crash of gold a couple of years ago. We got below 1,200. I fully expect it. Test. We'll see a test of that 1,200 level sometime this summer during a seasonal low. Historic seasonal low for gold prices is oftentimes in July and August. I made the prediction not long ago that gold would end the year higher than it started the year. If memory serves, it started the year something 1225, something like that. So, we're 1275, I think, today, more or less. I do not see any big movement upward in gold, nor do I see big movements downward in gold through the end of the year.
Mickey, I appreciate it, buddy.
Hey, thanks a lot, Alan. Always my pleasure.
Me too.